but Caroline more and more openly encouraged the older boys to laugh at their grandparents and to tell stories about Alfred's cluelessness. He called it Intendo, and Enid's Puritanism. She asked what the show was rated, and Enid's parsimony. There were two green beans, and she wrapped them up in foil. And Gary, since his surrender, had begun to join in the laughter himself. Grandma is funny, isn't she? And finally, Jonah became self-conscious about his plans. At the age of 8, he fell under the tyranny of cool. First, he ceased to bring up Christmas at the dinner table. And then when Caleb, with his trademark semi-irony, asked if he was looking forward to Christmasland, Jonah replied, in an effortfully wicked voice, "It's probably really stupid." "Lots of fat people in big cars driving around in the dark," Aaron said. "Telling each other how wonderful it is," Caroline said. "Wonderful, wonderful," Caleb said. "You shouldn't make fun of your grandmother," Gary said. "They're not making fun of her," Caroline said. "Right, we're not," Caleb said. "It's just that people are funny in St. Jude, aren't they, Jonah?" "People certainly are very large there," Jonah said. On Saturday night, 3 days ago, Jonah had thrown up after dinner and gone to bed with a mild fever. By Sunday evening, his color and appetite were back to normal, and Caroline played her final trump. For Aaron's birthday, earlier in the month, she'd bought an expensive computer game, God Project 2, in which players designed and operated organisms to compete in a working ecosystem. She hadn't allowed Aaron and Caleb to start the game until classes ended, and now, when they finally did start, she insisted that they let Jonah be microbes, because microbes in any ecosystem had the most fun and never lost. By bedtime on Sunday, Jonah was entranced with his team of killer bacteria and looked forward to sending them into battle the next day. When Gary woke him on Monday morning and asked if he was coming to St. Jude, Jonah said he'd rather stay home. "It's your choice," Gary said. "But it would mean a lot to your grandma if you came."
"What if it's not fun, though?"
"There's never a guarantee that something's going to be fun," Gary said. "But you'll make grandma happy. That's one thing I can guarantee." Jonah's face clouded.
"Can I think about it for an hour?"
"Okay, 1 hour, but then we have to pack and go." The end of the hour found Jonah deeply immersed in God Project 2. One strain of his bacteria had blinded 80% of Aaron's small-hoofed mammals.
"It's okay not to go," Caroline assured Jonah. "Your personal choice is what matters here. This is your vacation."
"Nobody will be forced to go."
"I'll say it one more time," Gary said. "Your grandma is really looking forward to seeing you."
To Caroline's face there came a desolation, a deep, tearful stare reminiscent of the troubles in September. She rose without a word and left the entertainment room. Jonah's answer came in a voice not much louder than a whisper.
"I think I'm going to stay here."
If it had still been September, Gary might have seen in Jonah's decision a parable of the crisis of moral duty in a culture of consumer choice. He might have become depressed. But he'd been down that road now, and he knew there was nothing for him at the end of it. He packed his bag and kissed Caroline.
"I'll be happy when you're back," she said.
In a strict moral sense, Gary knew he hadn't done anything wrong. He'd never promised Enid that Jonah was coming. It was simply to spare himself an argument that he'd lied about Jonah's fever. Similarly, to spare Enid's feelings, he hadn't mentioned that in the 6 business days since the IPO, his 5,000 shares of Axon Corporation stock, for which he'd paid $60,000, had risen in value to $118,000. Here again, he'd done nothing wrong. But given the pitiful size of Alfred's patent licensing fee from Axon, concealment seemed the wisest policy. The same also went for the little package Gary had zipped into the inside pocket of his jacket.
Jets were dropping from the bright sky, happy in their metal skins, while he jockeyed through the crush of senior traffic converging at the airport. The days before Christmas were the St. Jude Airport's finest hour, its raison d'être almost. Every garage was full and every walkway thronged. Denise was right on time, however. Even the airlines conspired to protect her from the embarrassment of a late arrival or an inconvenienced brother. She was standing, per family custom, at a little used gate on the departure level. Her overcoat was a crazy garnet woolen thing with pink velvet trim, and something about her head seemed different to Gary, more makeup than usual, maybe. More lipstick. Each time he'd seen Denise in the last year, most recently at Thanksgiving, she'd looked more emphatically unlike the person he'd always imagined that she would grow up to be. When he kissed her, he smelled cigarettes. "You've become a smoker," he said, making room in the trunk for her suitcase and shopping bag. Denise smiled. "Unlock the door, I'm freezing." Gary flipped open his sunglasses. Driving south into glare, he was nearly sideswiped while merging. Road aggression was encroaching in St. Jude. Traffic no longer moved so sluggishly that an eastern driver could pleasurably slalom through it. "I bet Mom's happy Jonah's here," Denise said. "As a matter of fact, Jonah is not here." Her head turned sharply. "You didn't bring him?" "He got sick." "I can't believe it. You didn't bring him." She seemed not to have considered, even for a moment, that he might be telling the truth. "There are 5 people in my house," Gary said. "As far as I know, there's only 1 in yours. Things are more complicated when you have multiple responsibilities." "I'm just sorry you had to get Mom's hopes up." "It's not my fault if she chooses to live in the future." "You're right," Denise said. "It's not your fault. I just wish it hadn't happened." "Speaking of Mom," Gary said, "I want to tell you a very weird thing, but you have to promise not to tell her."
"What weird thing?"
"Promise you won't tell her." Denise so promised, and Gary unzipped the inner pocket of his jacket and showed her the package that Beam Meisner had given him the day before. The moment had been fully bizarre. Chuck Meisner's Jaguar in the street, idling amid cetacean puffs of winter exhaust, B. Meisner standing on the welcome mat in her embroidered green loden coat, while she dug from her purse a seedy and much-handled little packet, Gary setting down the wrapped bottle of champagne and taking delivery of the contraband.
"This is for your mother," B. had said. "But you must tell her that Klaus says to be very careful with this. He didn't want to give it to me at all. He says it can be very, very addictive, which is why I only got a little bit. She wanted 6 months, but Klaus would only give me 1. So you tell her to be sure and talk to her doctor. Maybe, Gary, you should even hold on to it until she does that. Anyway, have a wonderful Christmas," here the Jaguar's horn beeped, "and give our best love to everyone."
Gary recounted this to Denise while she opened the packet. B had folded up a page torn from a German magazine and taped it shut. On one side of the page was a bespectacled German cow promoting ultra-pasteurized milk. Inside were 30 golden pills.
"My God," Denise laughed. "Mexican A."
"Never heard of it," Gary said.
"Club drug, very young person."
"And B. Meisner is delivering it to Mom at our front door."
"Does Mom know you took it?"
"Not yet. I don't even know what this stuff does." Denise reached over with her smoky fingers and put a pill near his mouth.
"Try one."
Gary jerked his head away. His sister seemed to be on some drug herself, something stronger than nicotine. She was greatly happy or greatly unhappy or a dangerous combination of the two. She was wearing silver rings on 3 fingers and a thumb.
"Is this a drug you've tried?" he said.
"No, I stick with alcohol."
She folded up the packet and Gary took control of it again. "I want to make sure you're with me on this," he said. "Do you agree that Mom should not be receiving illegal addictive substances from B. Meisner?"
"No," Denise said, "I don't agree. She's an adult and she can do what she wants. And I don't think it's fair to take her pills without telling her. If you don't tell her, I will."
"Excuse me, I believe you promised not to," Gary said.
Denise considered this. salt-splashed embankments were flying past.
"Okay, maybe I promised," she said. "But why are you trying to run her life?"
"I think you'll see," he said, "that the situation is out of hand. I think you'll see that it's about time somebody stepped in and ran her life."
Denise didn't argue with him. She put on shades and looked at the towers of Hospital City on the brutal south horizon. Gary had hoped to find her more cooperative. He already had one alternative sibling, and he didn't need another. It frustrated him that people could so happily drop out of the world of conventional expectations. It undercut the pleasure he took in his home and job and family. It felt like a unilateral rewriting to his disadvantage of the rules of life. He was especially galled that the latest defector to the alternative was not some flaky other from a family of others or a class of others, but his own stylish and talented sister, who as recently as September had excelled in conventional ways that his friends could read about in the New York Times. Now she'd quit her job and was wearing four rings and a flaming coat and reeking of tobacco. Carrying the aluminum stool, he followed her into the house. He compared her reception by Enid to the reception he'd received the day before. He took note of the duration of the hug, the lack of instant criticism, the smiles all around. Enid cried,
"I thought maybe you'd run into Chip at the airport and all three of you would be coming home."
"That scenario is implausible in 8 different ways," Gary said.
"He told you he'd be here today?" Denise said. "This afternoon," Enid said. "Tomorrow at the latest."
"Today, tomorrow, next April," Gary said. "Whatever."
"He said there was some trouble in Lithuania," Enid said.
While Denise went to find Alfred, Gary fetched the Morning Chronicle from the den. In a box of international news sandwiched between lengthy features, "New pedicures make dogs red in claw," and "Are ophthalmologists overpaid? Docs say no, optometrists say yes." He located a paragraph about Lithuania. "Civil unrest following disputed parliamentary elections and attempted assassination of President Vitkunas. 3/4 of the country without electricity, rival paramilitary groups clashing on the streets of Vilnius, and the airport..." "The airport is closed," Gary read aloud with satisfaction. "Mother, did you hear me?"
"He was already at the airport yesterday," Enid said. "I'm sure he got out."
"Then why hasn't he called?"
"He was probably running to catch a flight."
At a certain point, Enid's capacity for fantasy became physically painful to Gary. He opened his wallet and presented her with the receipt for the shower stool and safety bar.
"I'll write you a check later," she said.
"How about now before you forget?"
Muttering and soughing, Enid complied with his wishes. Gary examined the check.
"Why is this dated December 26th?
"Because that's the soonest you could possibly deposit it in Philadelphia."
Their skirmishing continued through lunch. Gary slowly drank a beer and slowly drank a second, relishing the distress that he was causing Enid as she told him for a third time and a fourth time that he'd better get started on that shower project. When he finally stood up from the table, it occurred to him that his impulse to run Enid's life was the logical response to her own insistence on running his. The safety shower bar was a 15-inch length of beige enamel pipe with flanged elbows at each end. The stubby screws included in the package might have sufficed to attach the bar to plywood, but were useless with ceramic tile. To secure the bar, he would have to run 6-inch bolts through the wall into the little closet behind the shower. Down in Alfred's workshop, he was able to find masonry bits for the electric drill, but the cigar boxes that he remembered as cornucopias of useful hardware seemed mainly to contain corroded, orphaned screws and strike plates and toilet tank fittings. Certainly no 6-inch bolts. Departing for the hardware store, wearing his "I'm a jerk" smile, he noticed Enid at the dining room windows, peering out through a sheer curtain.
"Mother," he said, "I think it's important not to get your hopes up about Chip."
"I just thought I heard a car door in the street."
Fine, go ahead, Gary thought as he left the house. Fixate on whoever isn't here and oppress whoever is. On the front walk, he passed Denise, who was returning from the supermarket with groceries. I hope you're letting Mom pay for those, he said. His sister laughed in his face. What difference does it make to you? She's always trying to get away with things. It burns me up. So redouble your vigilance, Denise said, proceeding toward the house. Why, exactly, had he been feeling guilty? He'd never promised to bring Jonah on the trip, and although he was currently ahead by $58,000 on his Axon investment, he'd worked hard for those shares, and he'd taken all the risk. And B. Meisner herself had urged him not to give Enid the addictive drug, so why had he felt guilty? As he drove, he imagined the needle on his cranial pressure gauge creeping clockwise. He was sorry he'd offered his services to Enid. Given the brevity of his visit, it was stupid to spend the afternoon on a job she should have paid a handyman to do. At the hardware store, he stood in the checkout line behind the fattest and slowest people in the central tier of steaks. They'd come to buy marshmallow Santas, packages of tinsel, Venetian blinds, $8 blow dryers, and holiday-themed potholders. With their bratwurst fingers, they dug for exact change in tiny purses. White cartoon puffs of steam shot out of Gary's ears, all the fun things he could be doing instead of waiting half an hour to buy 6 6-inch bolts assumed ravishing form in his imagination. He could be visiting the collector's room at the Museum of Transport gift shop, or sorting out the old bridge and track drawings from his father's early career at the Midland Pacific, or searching the under-porch storeroom for his long-missing O-gauge model railroad equipment. With the lifting of his depression, he'd developed a new interest, hobby-like in its intensity, in frameable and collectible railroad memorabilia, and he could happily have spent the whole day, the whole week, pursuing it. Back at the house, as he was heading up the walk, he saw the sheer curtains part, his mother peering out again. Inside, the air was steamy and dense with the smell of foods that Denise was baking, simmering, and browning. Gary gave Enid the receipt for the bolts, which she regarded as the token of hostility that it was.
You can't afford $4.96?
Mother, he said, I'm doing the work like I promised. But this is not my bathroom. This is not my safety bar.
I'll get the money for you later.
You might forget.
Gary, I will get the money for you later.
Denise, in an apron, followed this exchange from the kitchen doorway with laughing eyes. When Gary made his second trip to the basement, Alfred was snoring in the big blue chair. Gary proceeded into the workshop, and here he was stopped in his tracks by a new discovery. A shotgun in a canvas case was leaning against the lab bench. He didn't remember having seen it here earlier. Could he have somehow failed to notice it? Ordinarily, the gun was kept in the under-porch storeroom. He was sorry indeed to see that it had moved. Do I let him shoot himself? The question was so clear in his mind that he almost spoke it out loud. And he considered. It was one thing to intervene on behalf of Enid's safety and confiscate her drugs. There was life and hope and pleasure worth saving in Enid. The old man, however, was kaput. At the same time, Gary had no wish to hear a gunshot and come down and wade into the gore. He didn't want his mother to go through this either. And yet, horrible though the mess would be, it would be followed by a huge quantum uptick in the quality of his mother's life. Gary opened the box of shells on the bench and saw that none were missing. He wished that someone else, not he, had noticed that Alfred had moved the gun. But his decision when it came was so clear in his mind that he did speak it out loud. Into the dusty, uric, non-reverberative silence of the laboratory, he said, "If that's what you want, be my guest. I ain't gonna stop you." Before he could drill holes in the shower, he had to clear the shelves of the little bathroom closet. This in itself was a substantial job. Enid had saved in a shoebox every cotton ball she'd ever taken from a bottle of aspirin or prescription medication. There were 500 or 1,000 cotton balls. There were petrified, half-squeezed tubes of ointment. There were plastic pitchers and utensils, in colors even worse, if possible, than beige, from Enid's admissions to the hospital for foot surgery, knee surgery, and phlebitis. There were dear little bottles of mercurochrome and ambisol that had dried up sometime in the 1960s. There was a paper bag that Gary quickly, for the sake of his composure, threw to the back of a high shelf because it appeared to contain ancient menstrual belts and pads. The daylight was fading by the time he had the closet empty and was ready to drill 6 holes. It was then that he discovered that the old masonry bits were as dull as rivets. He leaned into the drill with all his weight. The tip of the bit turned bluish-black and lost its temper, and the old drill began to smoke. Sweat came pouring down his face and chest. Alfred chose this moment to step into the bathroom.
"Well, look at this," he said.
"You got some pretty dull masonry bits here," Gary said, breathing heavily. "I should have bought some new ones while I was at the store."
"Let me see," Alfred said.
It hadn't been Gary's intention to attract the old man and the agitated twin-fingered animals that were his advance guard. He shied from the incapacity and greedy openness of these hands, but Alfred's eyes were fixed on the drill now, his face bright with the possibility of solving a problem. Gary relinquished the drill. He wondered how his father could even see what he was holding. The drill shook so violently. The old man's fingers crawled around its tarnished surface, groping like eyeless worms.
"You got it on reverse," he said,
with the ridged yellow nail of his thumb. Alfred pushed the polarity switch to forward and handed the drill back to Gary, and for the first time since his arrival, their eyes met. The chill that ran through Gary was only partly from his cooling sweat. The old man, he thought, still had a few lights on upstairs. Alfred, indeed, looked downright happy, happy to have fixed a thing, and even happier, Gary suspected, to have proved that he was smarter in this tiny instance than his son.
"We can see why I'm not an engineer," Gary said.
"What's the project?"
"I'm putting in this bar to hold on to. Are you going to use the shower if we put a stool and a bar in here?"
"I don't know what they have planned for me," Alfred said as he was leaving.
"That was your Christmas present," Gary told him silently. "Flipping that switch was your present from me." An hour later, he had the bathroom back together and was in a fully nasty mood again. Enid had second-guessed his sighting of the bar, and Alfred, when Gary invited him to try the new stool, had announced that he preferred a bath.
"I've done my part, and now I'm done," Gary said in the kitchen, pouring liquor. "Tomorrow I have a few things that I want to do."
"It's a wonderful improvement in the bathroom," Enid said. Gary poured heavily, poured and poured.
"Oh, Gary," she said, "I thought we might open that champagne Bea brought us."
"Oh, let's not," said Denise, who had baked a stollen, a coffee cake, and 2 loaves of cheese bread, and was preparing, if Gary was not mistaken, a dinner of polenta and braised rabbit. Safe to say, it was the first time this kitchen had ever seen a rabbit. Enid returned to hovering by the dining room windows.
"I'm worried that he isn't calling," she said.
Gary joined her by the window, his glial cells purring with the first sweet lubrication of his drink. He asked if she was familiar with Occam's razor.
"Occam's razor," he said with cocktail sententiousness, "invites us to choose the simpler of 2 explanations for a phenomenon."
"Well, what's your point?" Enid said.
My point, he said, is that it's possible that Chip hasn't called you because of something complicated that we know nothing about, or it could be because of something very simple and well known to us, namely his incredible irresponsibility.
He said he was coming, and he said he would call, Enid answered flatly. He said, I'm coming home.
All right, fine. Stand at the window. It's your choice. Because he was expected to drive to the Nutcracker, Gary couldn't do as much drinking as he might have wished before dinner. He therefore did quite a bit more as soon as the family came home from the ballet, and Alfred headed upstairs, practically at a run, and Enid bedded down in the den with the intention of letting her children handle any problems in the night. Gary drank scotch and checked in with Caroline. He drank scotch and searched the house for Denise and found no sign of her. From his own room, he fetched his Christmas packages and arranged them under the tree. He was giving everybody the same gift, a leather-bound copy of the all-time Lambert 200 album. He'd pushed hard to get all the printing done in time for the holiday, and now that the album was complete, he planned to dismantle the dark room, spend some of his Exxon profits, and build a model railroad set up on the second floor of the garage. It was a hobby that he'd chosen for himself rather than having it chosen for him, and as he laid his scotchy head on the cold pillow and turned out the light in his old St. Judean bedroom, he was gripped by an ancient excitement at the prospect of running trains through mountains of papier-mâché across high popsicle stick trestles. He dreamed 10 Christmases in the house. He dreamed of rooms and people, rooms and people. He dreamed that Denise was not his sister and was going to murder him. His only hope was the shotgun in the basement. He was examining this shotgun, making sure that it was loaded, when he felt an evil presence behind him in the workshop. He turned around and didn't recognize Denise. The woman he saw was some other woman whom he had to kill or be killed by. And there was no resistance in the shotgun's trigger. It dangled, limp and futile. The gun was on reverse, and by the time he got it on forward, she was coming to kill him. He woke up, needing to pee. The darkness in his room was relieved only by the glow of the digital clock radio, whose face he didn't check because he didn't want to know how early it still was. He could dimly see the loaf of Chip's old bed by the opposite wall. The silence of the house felt momentary and unpeaceful. Recently fallen. Honoring this silence, Gary eased himself out of bed and crept toward the door, and here the terror struck him. He was afraid to open the door. He strained to hear what was happening outside it. He thought he could hear vague shiftings and creepings, faraway voices. He was afraid to go to the bathroom because he didn't know what he would find there. He was afraid that if he left his room, he would find the wrong person, his mother maybe, or his sister, or his father, in his bed when he came back. He was convinced that people were moving in the hallway. In his clouded, imperfect wakefulness, he connected the Denise who'd disappeared before he went to bed to the Denise-like phantom who was trying to kill him in his dream. The possibility that this phantom killer was even now lurking in the hall seemed only 90% fantastical. It was safer all around, he thought, to stay in his room and pee into one of the decorative Austrian beer steins on his dresser. But what if his tinkling attracted the attention of whoever was creeping around outside his door? Moving on tiptoe, he took a beer stein into the closet that he'd shared with Chip ever since Denise was given the smaller bedroom and the boys were put together. He pulled the closet door shut after him, crowded up against the dry-cleaned garments and the bursting Nordstrom bags of miscellany that Enid had taken to storing here, and relieved himself into the beer stein. He lipped a fingertip over the rim so that he could feel if he was going to overflow it. Just when the warmth of rising urine had reached this fingertip, his bladder finally emptied. He lowered the stein to the closet floor, took an envelope from a Nordstrom bag, and covered the mouth of the receptacle. Quietly, quietly, then, he left the closet and returned to his bed. As he was swinging his legs off the floor, he heard Denise's voice. It was so distinct and conversational that she might have been in the room with him. She said, "Gary?" He tried not to move, but the bed springs creaked. "Gary, sorry to bother you. Are you awake?" He had little choice now but to get up and open the door. Denise was right outside it, wearing white flannel pajamas and standing in a shaft of light from her own bedroom. "Sorry," she said. "Dad's been calling for you."
"Gary?"
came Alfred's voice from the bathroom by her room. Gary, heart thudding, asked what time it was. "I have no idea," she said. "He woke me up calling Chip's name, then he started calling yours, but not mine. I think he's more comfortable with you." Cigarettes on her breath again.
"Gary! Gary!" came the call from the bathroom.
"Fuck this," Gary said. "It could be his medication."
"Bullshit!"
from the bathroom.
"Gary!"
"Yeah, Dad, okay, I'm coming." Enid's bodiless voice floated up from the bottom of the stairs. "Gary, help your father."
"Yeah, Mom, I'm all over it. You just go back to sleep."
"What does he want?" Enid said.
"Just go back to bed."
Out in the hall, he could smell the Christmas tree and the fireplace. He tapped on the bathroom door and opened it. His father was standing in the bathtub, naked from the waist down, with nothing but psychosis in his face. Until now, Gary had seen faces like this mainly at the bus stops and the Burger King bathrooms of central Philadelphia.
"Gary," Alfred said, "they're all over the place."
The old man pointed at the floor with a trembling finger.
"Do you see him?"
"Dad, you're hallucinating."
"Get him! Get him!"
"You're hallucinating, and it's time to get out of the tub and go back to bed."
"Do you see them?"
"You're hallucinating. Go back to bed." This went on for a while, 10 or 15 minutes, before Gary was able to lead Alfred out of the bathroom. A light was burning in the master bedroom, and several unused diapers were spread out on the floor. It seemed to Gary that his father was having a dream while he was awake, a dream as vivid as Gary's own dream about Denise, and that the awakening that he, Gary, had accomplished in half a second was taking his father half an hour.
"What is hallucinate?" Alfred said finally.
"It's like you're dreaming when you're awake." Alfred winced.
"I'm concerned about this."
"Well, rightly so."
"Help me with the diaper."
"Yes, all right," Gary said.
"I'm concerned that something is wrong with my thoughts."
"Oh, Dad,
my head doesn't seem to work right."
"I know, I know." But Gary himself was infected, there in the middle of the night, by his father's disease. As the two of them collaborated on the problem of the diaper, which his father seemed to regard more as a lunatic conversation piece than as an undergarment to be donned, Gary, too, had a sensation of things dissolving around him, of a night that consisted of creepings and shiftings and metamorphoses. He had the sense that there were many more than two people in the house beyond the bedroom door. He sensed a large population of phantoms that he could glimpse only dimly. Alfred's polar hair was hanging in his face when he lay down. Gary pulled the blanket up over his shoulder. It was hard to believe that he'd been fighting with this man, taking him seriously as an adversary 3 months ago. His clock radio showed 2:55 when he returned to his room. The house was quiet again. Denise's door closed. The only sound, an 18-wheeler on the expressway half a mile away. Gary wondered why his room smelled faintly like somebody's cigarette breath. But maybe it wasn't cigarette breath. Maybe it was that Austrian beer stein full of piss that he'd left on the closet floor. "Tomorrow," he thought, "is for me. Tomorrow is Gary's recreation day, and then on Thursday morning we're going to blow this house wide open. We're going to put an end to this charade." After Brian Callahan had fired Denise, she'd carved herself up and put the pieces on the table. She told herself a story about a daughter in a family so hungry for a daughter that it would have eaten her alive if she hadn't run away. She told herself a story about a daughter who, in her desperation to escape, had taken refuge in whatever temporary shelters she could find, a career in cooking, a marriage to Emile Berger, an old person's life in Philadelphia, an affair with Robin Passafaro. But naturally, these refuges, chosen in haste, proved unworkable in the long run. By trying to protect herself from her family's hunger, the daughter accomplished just the opposite. She ensured that when her family's hunger reached its peak, her life would fall apart and leave her without a spouse, without kids, without a job, without responsibilities, without a defense of any kind. It was as if all along she'd been conspiring to make herself available to nurse her parents. Meanwhile, her brothers had conspired to make themselves unavailable. Chip had fled to Eastern Europe, and Gary had placed himself under Caroline's thumb. Gary, it was true, did take responsibility for his parents, but his idea of responsibility was to bully and give orders. The burden of listening to Enid and Alfred and being patient and understanding fell squarely on the daughter's shoulders. Already Denise could see that she would be the only child in St. Jude for Christmas dinner, and the only child on duty in the weeks and months and years after that. Her parents had better manners than to ask her to come and live with them, but she knew that this was what they wanted. As soon as she'd enrolled her father in Phase 2 testing of Correctol and offered to house him, Enid had unilaterally ceased hostilities with her. Enid had never again mentioned her adulterous friend Norma Green. She'd never asked Denise why she'd quit her job at the generator. Enid was in trouble. Her daughter was offering to help, and so she could no longer afford the luxury of finding fault. And now the time had come, according to the story that Denise told herself about herself, for the chef to carve herself up and feed the pieces to her hungry parents. Lacking a better story, she almost bought this one. The only trouble was, she didn't recognize herself in it. When she put on a white blouse, an antique gray suit, red lipstick, and a black pillbox hat with a little black veil, then she recognized herself. When she put on a sleeveless white T-shirt and boy's jeans and tied her hair back so tightly that her head ached, she recognized herself. When she put on silver jewelry, turquoise eyeshadow, corpse lip nail polish, a searing pink jumper and orange sneakers, she recognized herself as a living person and was breathless with the happiness of living. She went to New York to appear on the Food Channel and visit one of those clubs for people like herself who were starting to figure it out and needed practice. She stayed with Julia Vrace in Julia's outstanding apartment on Hudson Street. Julia reported that in the discovery phase of her divorce proceedings, she'd learned that Gitanas Misevičius had paid for this apartment with funds embezzled from the Lithuanian government. Gitanas's lawyer claims it was an oversight, Julia told Denise, but I find that hard to believe. Does this mean you're going to lose the apartment?
Well, no, Julia said. In fact, this makes it more likely that I'll get to keep it without paying anything. But still, I feel so awful. My apartment rightfully belongs to the people of Lithuania.
The temperature in Julia's extra bedroom was about 90. She gave Denise a foot-thick down comforter and asked if she wanted a blanket, too.
Thanks, this looks like plenty, Denise said.
Julia gave her flannel sheets and four pillows with flannel cases. She asked how Chip was doing in Vilnius. It sounds like he and Gitanas are the best of friends.
I hate to think what the two of them are saying about me, Julia mused happily.
Denise said that it wouldn't surprise her if Chip and Gitanas avoided the topic altogether.
Julia frowned. Why wouldn't they talk about me?
Well, you did painfully dump both of them.
But they could talk about how much they hate me.
I don't think anybody could hate you.
Actually, Julia said, I was afraid you'd hate me for breaking up with Chip.
No, I never had anything at stake there. clearly relieved to hear this. Julia confided to Denise that she was now being dated by a lawyer, nice but bald, with whom Eden Procuro had set her up.
"I feel safe with him," she said. "He's so confident in restaurants, and he's got tons of work, so he's not always after me for, you know, favors."
"Really?" Denise said. "The less you tell me about things with you and Chip, the happier I'll be." When Julia then asked if Denise was seeing anybody, it shouldn't have been so hard to tell her about Robin Passafaro, but it was very hard. Denise didn't want to make her friend uncomfortable, didn't want to hear her voice go small and soft with sympathy. She wanted to soak up Julia's company in its familiar innocence, and so she said, "I'm seeing nobody." Nobody, except the next night, at a Sapphic Pasha's den 200 steps from Julia's apartment, a 17-year-old, just off the bus from Plattsburgh, New York, with a drastic hairstyle and twin 800s on her recent SATs. She carried the official ETS printout like a certificate of sanity or possibly of madness. And then, the night after that, a religious studies major at Columbia whose father, she said, operated the largest sperm bank in Southern California. This accomplished, Denise went to a Midtown studio and taped her guest appearance on Pop Food for Now People, making lamb's meat ravioli and other Mare Scuro standards. She met with some of the New Yorkers who'd tried to hire her away from Brian, a couple of Central Park West trillionaires seeking a feudal relationship with her, a Munich banker who believed she was the Weisswurst Messiah who could restore German cooking to its former glory in Manhattan, and a young restaurateur, Nick Raza, who impressed her by itemizing and breaking down each of the meals he'd eaten at Mare Scuro and the generator. Raza came from a family of purveyors in New Jersey and already owned a popular mid-range seafood grill on the Upper East Side. Now he wanted to jump into the Smith Street culinary scene in Brooklyn with a restaurant that starred, if possible, Denise. She asked him for a week to think it over. On a sunny fall Sunday afternoon, she took the subway out to Brooklyn. The borough seemed to her a Philadelphia rescued by adjacency to Manhattan. In half an hour, she saw more beautiful, interesting-looking women than she saw in half a year in South Philly. She saw their brownstones and their nifty boots. Returning home by Amtrak, she regretted having hidden for so long in Philadelphia. The little subway station under City Hall was as empty and echoing as a battleship in mothballs. Every floor and wall and beam and railing was painted gray. Heartbreaking, the little train that finally pulled up after 15 minutes with a population of riders who in their patience and isolation were less like commuters than like emergency room supplicants. Denise surfaced from the Federal Street station among sycamore leaves and burger wrappers, racing in waves down the Broad Street sidewalk, swirling up against the pissy facades and barred windows and scattering among the Bondo-fendered cars that were parked at the curb. The urban vacancy of Philadelphia, the hegemony of wind and sky here, struck her as enchanted, as Narnian. She loved Philadelphia the way she loved Robin Passafaro. Her heart was full, and her senses were sharp, but her head felt liable to burst in the vacuum of her solitude. She unlocked the door of her brick penitentiary and collected her mail from the floor. Among the 20 people who'd left messages on her machine were Robin Passafaro, breaking her silence to ask if Denise might like to have a little chat, and Emile Berger politely informing her that he'd accepted Brian Callahan's offer of the job of executive chef at the generator and was moving back to Philadelphia. At this news from Emile, Denise kicked the tiled south wall of her kitchen until she was afraid she'd broken her toe. She said, "I've got to get out of here." But getting out was not so easy. Robin had had a month to cool off and conclude that if sleeping with Brian was a sin, then she was guilty of it also. Brian had rented a loft for himself in Old City, and Robin, as Denise had suspected, was dead set on keeping custody of Sinead and Erin. To strengthen her case, she stayed put in the big house on Panama Street and rededicated herself to motherhood. But she was free during school hours and all day on Saturday when Brian took the girls out, and on mature reflection she decided that these free hours might best be spent in Denise's bed. Denise still couldn't say no to the drug of Robin. She still wanted Robin's hands on her and at her and around her and inside her, that prepositional smorgasbord. But there was something in Robin, probably her propensity to blame herself for harms that other people inflicted on her, that invited betrayal and abuse. Denise went out of her way to smoke in bed now because cigarette smoke irritated Robin's eyes. She dressed to the hilt when she met Robin for lunch. She did her best to highlight Robin's dowdiness, and she held the gaze of anyone, female or male, who turned to look at her. She visibly winced at the volume of Robin's voice. She behaved like an adolescent with a parent, except that an adolescent couldn't help rolling her eyes, whereas Denise's contempt was a deliberate, calculated form of cruelty. She shushed Robin angrily when they were in bed, and Robin began to hoot self-consciously. She said, "Keep your voice down, please, please." Exhilarated by her own cruelty, she stared at Robin's Gore-Tex rain gear until Robin was provoked to ask why. Denise said, "I'm just wondering if you're ever tempted to be slightly less uncool." Robin replied that she was never going to be cool, and so she might as well be comfortable. Denise allowed her lip to curl. Robin was eager to bring her lover back into contact with Sinead and Aaron, but Denise, for reasons that she herself could only halfway fathom, refused to see the girls. She couldn't imagine looking them in the eye. The very thought of four-girl domesticity sickened her.
"They adore you," Robin said.
"I can't do it."
"Why not?"
"Because I don't feel like it, that's why."
"All right, whatever."
"How long is whatever going to be your word? Are you ever going to retire it, or is it your word for life?"
"Denise, they adore you," Robin squeaked. "They miss you, and you used to love to see them."
"Well, I'm not in a kid kind of mood. I don't know if I'll ever be, frankly. So please stop asking me."
By now, most people would have got the message. Most people would have cleared out and never come back. But Robin, it transpired, had a taste for cruel treatment. Robin said, and Denise believed her, that she would never have left Brian if Brian hadn't left her. Robin liked to be licked and stroked within a micron of coming and then abandoned and made to beg. And Denise liked to do this to her. Denise liked to get out of bed and get dressed and go downstairs while Robin waited for sexual release, because she wouldn't cheat and touch herself. Denise sat in the kitchen and read a book, and smoked, until Robin, humiliated, trembling, came down and begged. Denise's contempt, then, was so pure and so strong, it was almost better than sex. And so it went. The more Robin agreed to be abused, the more Denise enjoyed abusing her. She ignored Nick Raza's phone messages. She stayed in bed until 2 in the afternoon. Her social cigarette habit bloomed into craving. She indulged 15 years' accumulated laziness. She lived on her savings account. Every day, she considered all the work she had to do to prepare the house for her parents' arrival, putting a handle in the shower, carpeting the staircases, buying furniture for the living room, finding a better kitchen table, moving her bed down from the third floor and setting it up in the guest room, and concluded that she lacked the energy. Her life consisted of waiting for the axe to fall. If her parents were coming for 6 months, there was no point in starting something else. She had to get all her slacking off done now. What exactly her father thought about Correctol was difficult to know. The one time she asked him directly on the phone, he didn't answer.
"Al," Enid prompted, "Denise wants to know how you feel about Correctol."
Alfred's voice was sour.
"You'd think they could have found a better name than that."
"It's a completely different spelling," Enid said. "Denise wants to know if you're excited about the treatment."
Silence.
"Al, tell her how excited you are."
I find that my affliction gets a little worse every week. I can't see that another drug is going to make much difference.
Al, it's not a drug. It's a radical new therapy that uses your patent.
I've learned to put up with a certain amount of optimism, so we will stick to the plan.
Denise, Enid said, I can do lots to help out. I can make all the meals and do all the laundry. I think it will be a great adventure. It's so wonderful that you're offering.
Denise couldn't imagine 6 months with her parents in a house and a city she was done with. 6 months of invisibility as the accommodating and responsible daughter that she could barely pretend to be. She'd made a promise, however. And so she took her rage out on Robin. On the Saturday night before Christmas, she sat in her kitchen and blew smoke at Robin while Robin maddened her by trying to cheer her up.
You're giving them a great gift, Robin said, by inviting them to stay with you.
It would be a gift if I weren't a mess, Denise said. But you should only offer what you can actually deliver.
You can deliver it, Robin said. I'll help you. I can spend mornings with your dad and give your mom a break, and you can go off by yourself and do whatever you want. I'll come 3 or 4 mornings a week.
To Denise, Robin's offer only made the prospect of those mornings bleaker and more suffocating.
"Do you not understand?" she said. "I hate this house. I hate this city. I hate my life here. I hate family. I hate home. I'm ready to leave. I'm not a good person, and it only makes it worse to pretend I am." "I think you're a good person," Robin said. "I treat you like garbage. Have you not noticed? It's because you're so unhappy."
Robin came around the table and tried to lay a hand on her. Denise elbowed it aside. Robin tried again, and this time Denise caught her squarely in the cheek with the knuckles of her open hand. Robin backed away, her face crimson as if she were bleeding on the inside.
"You hit me," she said. "I'm aware of that. You hit me rather hard. Why did you do that?" "Because I don't want you here. I don't want to be part of your life. I don't want to be part of anybody's life. I'm sick of watching myself be cruel to you."
Interconnecting flywheels of pride and love were spinning behind Robin's eyes. It was a while before she spoke.
"Okay, then," she said. "I'll leave you alone."
Denise did nothing to stop her from leaving, but when she heard the front door close, she understood that she'd lost the only person who could have helped her when her parents came to town. She'd lost Robin's company, her comforts, everything she'd spurned a minute earlier. She wanted back. She flew to St. Jude. On her first day there, as on the first day of every visit, she warmed to her parents' warmth and did whatever her mother asked her to. She waved off the cash Enid tried to give her for the groceries. She refrained from commenting on the 4-ounce bottle of rancid yellow glue that was the only olive oil in the kitchen. She wore the lavender synthetic turtleneck and the matronly gold plate necklace that were recent gifts from her mother. She effused spontaneously about the adolescent ballerinas in the Nutcracker. She held her father's gloved hand as they crossed the regional theater's parking lot. She loved her parents more than she'd ever loved anything. And the minute they were both in bed, she changed her clothes and fled the house. She paused in the street, a cigarette on her lip, a matchbook, Dean and Trish, June 13, 1987, trembling in her fingers. She hiked to the field behind the grade school where she and Don Armour had once sat and smelled cattails and verbena. She stamped her feet, rubbed her hands, watched the clouds occult the constellations, and took deep fortifying breaths of selfhood. Later in the night, she undertook a clandestine operation on her mother's behalf, entering Gary's bedroom while he was occupied with Alfred, unzipping the inside pocket of his leather jacket, replacing the Mexican A with a handful of Advils, and spiriting Enid's drug away to a safer place before she finally, good daughter, fell asleep. On her second day in St. Jude, as on the second day of every visit, she woke up angry. The anger was an autonomous neurochemical event, no stopping it.
At breakfast, she was tortured by every word her mother said. Browning the ribs and soaking the sauerkraut according to ancestral custom, rather than in the modern style she'd developed at the generator, made her angry. So much grease, such sacrifice of texture. The bradykinetic languor of Enid's electric stove, which hadn't bothered her the day before, made her angry. The 101 refrigerator magnets, puppy dog sentimental in their iconography and so feeble in their pull that you could scarcely open the door without sending a snapshot of Jonah or a postcard of Vienna souping to the floor, filled her with rage. She went to the basement to get the ancestral 10-quart Dutch oven, and the clutter in the laundry room cabinets made her furious. She dragged a trash can in from the garage and began to fill it with her mother's crap. This was arguably helpful to her mother, and so she went at it with abandon. She threw away the Korean barfleberries, the 50 most obviously worthless plastic flower pots, the assortment of sand dollar fragments, and the sheaf of silver dollar plants whose dollars had all fallen off. She threw away the wreath of spray-painted pine cones that somebody had ripped apart. She threw away the brandy pumpkin spread that had turned a snottish gray-green. She threw away the Neolithic cans of hearts of palm and baby shrimps and miniature Chinese corn cobs, the turbid black liter of Romanian wine whose cork had rotted, the Nixon-era bottle of Mai Tai mix with an oozing crust around its neck, the collection of Paul Masson Chablis carafes with spider parts and moth wings at the bottom, the profoundly corroded bracket for some long-lost wind chimes. She threw away the quart glass bottle of Vest Diet Cola that had turned the color of plasma, the ornamental jar of brandied kumquats that was now a fantasia of rock candy and amorphous brown gunk, the smelly thermos whose broken inner glass tinkled when she shook it, the mildewed half-peck produce basket full of smelly yogurt cartons, the hurricane lanterns sticky with oxidation and brimming with severed moth wings, the lost empires of florist's clay and florist's tape that hung together even as they crumbled and rusted. At the very back of the closet, in the cobwebs behind the bottom shelf, she found a thick envelope, not old-looking, with no postage on it. The envelope was addressed to the Axon Corporation, 24 East Industrial Serpentine, Schwanksville, Pennsylvania. The return addressee was Alfred Lambert. The words, "Send Certified," were also on the face. Water was running in the little half-bathroom by her father's laboratory, the toilet tank refilling, faint sulfurous odors in the air. The door to the lab was ajar, and Denise knocked on it. "Yes?" Alfred said. He was standing by the shelves of exotic metals, the gallium and bismuth, and buckling his belt. She showed him the envelope and told him where she'd found it. Alfred turned it over in his shaking hands, as if an explanation might magically occur to him. "It's a mystery," he said. "Can I open it?"
"You may do as you wish."
The envelope contained three copies of a licensing agreement dated September 13th, signed by Alfred and notarized by David Schumpert. "What is this doing on the floor of the laundry room closet?" Denise said. Alfred shook his head.
"You'd have to ask your mother."
She went out to the bottom of the stairs and raised her voice. "Mom, can you come down here for a second?" Enid appeared at the top of the stairs, wiping her hands on a dish towel. "What is it? Can't you find the pot?" "I found the pot, but can you come down here?" Alfred, in the lab, was holding the Axon documents loosely, not reading them. Enid appeared in the doorway, with guilt on her face. "What?" "Dad wants to know why this envelope was in the laundry room closet." "Give me that," Enid said. She snatched the documents from Alfred and crumpled them in her fist. "This has all been taken care of. Dad signed another set of agreements, and they sent us a check right away. This is nothing to worry about." Denise narrowed her eyes. "I thought you said you'd sent these in. When we were in New York at the beginning of October, you said you'd sent these in. I thought I had, but they were lost in the mail." "In the mail?"
Enid waved her hands vaguely. Well, that's where I thought they were, but I guess they were in the closet. I must have set a stack of mail down there when I was going to the post office, and then this fell down behind. You know, I can't keep track of every last thing. Sometimes things get lost, Denise. I have a big house to take care of, and sometimes things get lost.
Denise took the envelope from Alfred's workbench.
It says, send certified. If you were at the post office, how did you not notice that something you needed to send certified was missing? How did you not notice that you weren't filling out a certified mail slip?
Denise, Alfred's voice had an angry edge, that's enough now.
I don't know what happened, Enid said. It was a busy time for me. It's a complete mystery to me, and let's just leave it that way, because it doesn't matter. Dad got his $5,000 just fine. It doesn't matter.
She further crumpled the licensing agreements and left the laboratory.
I'm developing Garyitis, Denise thought.
You shouldn't be so hard on your mother, Alfred said.
I know. I'm sorry.
But Enid was exclaiming in the laundry room, exclaiming in the ping-pong table room, returning to the workshop.
Denise, she cried, you've got the whole closet completely torn up. What on earth are you doing in there?
I'm throwing food away, food and other rotten junk.
All right, but why now? We have the whole weekend if you want to help me clean some closets out. It's wonderful if you want to help me, but not today. Let's not get into it today.
It's bad food, Mom. If you leave it long enough, it turns to poison. Anaerobic bacteria will kill you.
Well, get it cleaned up now, and let's do the rest on the weekend.
We don't have time for that today. I want you to work on dinner so it's all ready, and you don't have to think about it, and then I really want you to help Dad with his exercises, like you said you would.
I will do that.
Al, Enid shouted, leaning past her, Denise wants to help you with your exercises after lunch.
He shook his head as if with disgust.
As you wish.
Stacked up on one of the old family bedspreads that had long served as a dropcloth were wicker chairs and tables in early stages of scraping and painting. Lidded coffee cans were clustered on an open section of newspaper. A gun in a canvas case was by the workbench.
What are you doing with a gun, Dad? Denise said.
Oh, he's been meaning to sell that for years, Enid said.
Al, are you ever going to sell that gun?
Alfred seemed to run this sentence through his brain several times in order to extract its meaning. Very slowly, he nodded his head.
Yes, he said. I will sell the gun.
I hate having it in the house, Enid said as she turned to leave. You know, he never used it, not once.